Thanks, Michael. Thank you for coming out for poetry. Having been stuck on the metro for a while myself, well, I know there's trouble out there. But I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad that you are too. On the screen and playing music as you came in were the lyrics from a mathematical song called Mandelbrot Set by Jonathan Colton. And Mandelbrot Set and a number of the poems that you'll hear this evening are in the anthology that Michael has mentioned. And I think it would be fair to say that this reading came because of the anthology. And the anthology came because of Sarah Glaz, the other co-editor of it with me. About 7 years ago, she contacted me and she said, I have an idea that you could help with. Well, it demanded a lot more help than I wanted, but she was persistent, and we have a very nice volume, which is now available with over more than 100 poets and more than 150 poems, all of which are related to mathematics in some way. Both Karen and I have poems in the anthology, and that unites us here this evening. We're going to read poems that relate to a particular, we selected a number of themes, and we'll read several poems related to themes as we go on. After I read an introductory poem, why then our first theme will be algebra and equations. But I'd like to kind of set the stage with a poem that talks about the nature of mathematics. It's set at a joint math conference in January 1993 at one of my favorite conference cities, which was San Antonio. So here is a poem, San Antonio, January 1993. A mathematician left the convention focused on 9, the digit that sits in the billionth decimal place of pi, ratio of circumference to width of the yellow circle that parted the clouds as she strolled down Commerce Street to the Rio Rio Cafe for lunch and a beer. On fire with jalapenos, she went shopping for a souvenir. She bought earrings, red, red peppers with green stems. She said, hot peppers are like mathematics, with strong flavor that takes over what they enter. And now here's Karen with beginning our group on algebra and equations.
Thank you all for coming. This is a poem that didn't make it into the anthology. It's funny, but as I was looking at this poem, it's called The Odds. There were a couple things that occurred to me. One was the original title of it was Solving for Y. And the other thing that occurred to me that these three poems that we're going to read in this particular category also deal with the element of travel. So here's my poem, it'll go by fairly quickly. The Odds. I am the constant K, and you are Y in any function making Z. Here I am driving along in second gear on a road with no parking and blocks of green lights, while the vehicle agonizes for third. Solving for Y is hard work, and I don't know where to stop. I like progressions. Curiosity comes into play. But where am I going? In what ratio will I find you?
Our next poem is by Linda Paston, one of my favorite poets. Linda lives nearby in Maryland, and for 4 years had a term as poet laureate of that state. Here is Algebra by Linda Paston. I used to solve equations easily. In train A, left Sioux Falls at 9 o'clock, traveling at a fixed rate, I knew when it would meet train B. Now I wonder if the trains will crash, or else I picture naked limbs through Pullman windows, each a small vignette of longing. And I knew X, or thought I did, shuffled back and forth like a poor goat across the equal sign. X was the unknown on a motorbike, those autumn days when leaves flew past the color of pencil shavings. Obedient as a genie, it gave me answers to what I thought were questions. Unsolved equations later and winter now, I know X better than I did. His is the scarecrow's bitter mouth, sewn shut in cross-stitch, the footprint of a weasel on snow. X is the unknown assailant. X marks the spot toward which we speed like trains at a fixed rate.
The third poem in this particular category really speaks to Linda Paskin's poem. It's by Yehuda Amichai, who is Israel's most popular poet. And he has won many prizes and certainly is a treasure in his own country, but most people know him here as well. And this translation from the Hebrew is by Hannah Luck and Hannah Kronfeld. And it's actually a sonnet that is extracted from Israeli travel. Otherness is all, otherness is love. I remember a problem in a math book about a train that leaves from place A and another train that leaves from place B. When will they meet? No one ever asked what happens when they meet. Will they stop or pass each other or collide? None of the problems was about a man who leaves from place A and a woman who leaves from place B. When will they meet? Will they meet at all and for how long? As for the math book, now, I've reached the final pages with the answers. Back then, it was forbidden to look. Now, it is permitted. Now, I check where I was right and where I was wrong, and I know what I did well and what I did not do. Amen. Now, let's see, the next category is geometry, and Joanne will begin this particular set.
There are firsts for everything, and this particular poem, I think, is my first consciousness of a poem that used mathematical imagery but was not jargon. James Galvin is from Wyoming, but he read in a literary series at the university where I taught back in the 80s, and I heard him read this poem at that time. Geometry is the mind of God. The title of the poem is a quotation from Kepler, and the first two lines are from Euclid's Elements. Geometry is the mind of God, by James Galvin. A point is that which has no part. A line is a breadthless length. A man in his life is a point on a line. That which has no part on a breadthless length. The far horizon is a line made of vanishing points, near collision of funneling views, flat as a corpse's EKG. The line to my back is a heart attack of granite and ice, a couple of similar opposites. The opposite of a mountain is the ocean or the sky, or an island in the ocean, or an island in the sky, or a thorn on the island. Well, and what regards the reeling firmament with sympathy? If the ocean has an island, if the point has no heart, I'd say it's the green thorn in my heart. A second geometry poem, this time with the title simply Geometry, is by Rita Dove, a former poet laureate of the United States and the first African American to serve as poet laureate. Rita Dove has written several poems involving her childhood studies that involve working with her father on homework and such. Geometry by Rita Dove. I prove a theorem, and the house expands. The windows jerk free to hover near the ceiling. The ceiling floats away with a sigh. As the walls clear themselves of everything but transparency, the scent of carnations leaves with them. I am out in the open, and above, the windows have hinged into butterflies, sunlight glinting where they've intersected. They are going to some point, true and unproven.
This poem is by Stanley Kunitz, who was also a consultant in poetry to the Library of Congress before they made it a laureate title. And he certainly was interested in science and mathematics all his long, very long career in writing poetry, and quite a treasure. So this is the geometry of moods. Concentrical, the universe and I rotated on God's crystal axle tree. So perfectly adjusted in suspense, I could not mark our split circumference. But sphere in sphere, devotion in devotion, was a thing of folding air, a windy motion. My spinal pole, tipped with a globe of light, stretched long as time into the infinite. And when I turned to look upon the face of love's incarnate form, tremendous space inclined upon her mouth, the natural nest where, throbbing like a bird, singed thought might rest, singed thought might rest. Concentrical, the universe and I rotated on God's crystal axle tree, I, core of the world, a bead in a ball of glass, so pure that only nothing could be less. Oh, the earth ensphered me, liberal and warm, where the curve of heaven was her sleeping arm. Now, cubical upon a fractured pole, it creaks, scraping the circle of my soul. Now the next section are concrete poems. So these are poems that make a picture. And with a little bit of luck here, maybe I can figure out where to open these. Emily's going to one from the rest of And let's see, the order in which I want to do this is so this poem that's coming up is called Mathimaku number 10. And Bob Gorman is a poet and critic from Florida. And as you see, existence divided by poetry equals, I guess, love. And so he says, somewhere minutely, a widening existence. for me. It's by Ray Bobo. He's a retired Georgetown University math professor, and he's published in College Mathematics Journal and the American Mathematical Monthly. And I'm going to read you the text of Give Me an Epsilon and I Will Treat It Well. On the left side are his mathematical notations that are found in this text according to how this is supposed to be interpreted. So, found alone and wanting, I now languish unbegone. First, that's your first x equals zero. Okay? Oh, to have your arms about me be transformed into the one. Closeness for our angels is returned with an embrace. So I guess you have infinity is equal to, what is that symbol?
It should be an arrow. There's something that the computer didn't recognize, but then it was
No, the second one is something like that. It's an E or something.
Oh, Epsilon.
Okay. So that's your epsilon. Okay. And then so that by incorporation we can soar to loving space. In meaningful, in asking all. Amen. So here we have another, shall we say, curtsy to, you know, the greater beyond. Amakai did it in his poem, and Ray Bobo does it here in this particular poem. Okay. And the final poem is called Useless. And it's by Randall Monroe. And Monroe has a degree in physics, and he worked for a time on robots for NASA. And now he's an internet artist and cartoonist, and you can find him and his work at xkcdandcharliedandog.com. xkcd.com. Now, this is an interesting thing. I guess you have like the square root of love equals he didn't know. He didn't know what the cosine of love was and
the derivative.
He couldn't figure these things out. And then, you know, the function. This got very complicated. So this is my normal approach here is useless. I guess his approach to love was the thing that he was having such a hard time with. So the Strange Attractors anthology, the subtitle is Poems of Love and Mathematics. So ergo, these particular concrete poems all address that subject of love. So now back to our next category. We have Women and Mathematics. And Joanne, you're up.
I'll mention one more thing. I actually thought it might be possible to go outside and put this on, but I didn't get to it. This is how Randall Monroe makes a living is by warehousing on his, or by whatever word. He sells things on his cartoon website. So anyhow, I have the t-shirt. And one of the interesting things, when I wore this at the joint meetings in D.C., I wore it, you know, walking down the hallway, and people would say, oh, what a neat t-shirt. Where did you get that? And when I wore it at a writer's conference in Chicago, nobody even saw what was on my t-shirt. So it was an interesting revelation about, you know, about the understanding of the notation and just what the poem meant. So it's sort of nice always to be on the side of the people who know. So often in literary circles, those of us who know mathematics are the people who are trying to hang on by our fingernails. One more thing, the cover of the anthology was also designed by Randall Monroe. This next poem gets serious. And when I say serious, the poem was first published in the Mathematics magazine in 1995, and I wrote it to honor the mathematician, the algebraist, Emmy Noda. And what I have discovered since the time of writing is that actually speaks about some of my own attitudes, too, as a woman in mathematics. The title of the poem is My Dance is Mathematics. It has an epigraph, which are a few lines by Edna St. Vincent Millay, and they are perhaps partly pertinent because they were delivered as part of a eulogy by mathematician Herman Weil at a memorial service for Emmy Noda when she died in 1935. The epigraph, down, down into the darkness of the grave, gently they go, the beautiful, the tender, the kind. Quietly they go, the intelligent, the witty, the brave. I know, but I do not approve, and I am not resigned. And here is, to honor Emmy Noda, My Dance is Mathematics. They called you Dear Noda, as if mathematics was only for men. In 1964, nearly 30 years past your death, at last I saw you in a spotlight, in a World's Fair mural, Men of Modern Mathematics. Colleagues praised your brilliance, but after, they had called you fat and plain, rough and loud. Some mentioned kindness and good humor, though none in your lifetime admitted it was you who led the way to axiomatic algebra. Direct and courageous, lacking self-concern, elegant of mind, a poet of logical ideas. At a party when you were 8 years old, you spoke up to solve a hard math puzzle. Fearless, you set yourself apart. I followed you. I saw you forced to choose between mathematics and other romance. For women only, this exclusive standard. I heard father say, dance with Emmy just once, early in the evening. Old Max is my friend, and his daughter likes to dance. If a woman's dance is mathematics, she dances alone. Mother said, don't tease. That strange one's heart is kind. She helps her mother clean the house and cannot help her curious mind. Teacher said, she's smart but stubborn, contentious and loud, a theory builder not persuaded by our ideas. Students said, she's hard to follow, bores me. A few stood firm and built new algebras on her exacting formulations. In spite of Emmy's talents, always there were reasons not to give her rank or permanent employment. She's a pacifist, a woman. She's a woman and a Jew. Her abstract thinking is female and abstruse. Today, history books proclaim that Noda is the greatest mathematician her sex has produced. They say she was good for a woman.
This poem is by Kyoko Mori. She teaches at George Mason University. She's primarily known for her fiction, but she writes poetry, short stories, and novels. Barbie says math is hard. As a boy, I still have asked why Jack must spend exactly $2 at the corner store. Give him a purse, a coin purse, is as good an answer as 5 apples and 2 oranges. Also, would he bake the apples into pies or cobblers, save the orange peel in a glass jar to spice up his tea or cake? If his father paints their house with Mr. Jones, which man will take the peaks and why? Would the raspberry beetle swarm over wet paint? Why is Mr. Jones slower than his neighbor? If X equals Y, is it like putting apples into coleslaw the way a tomato is really a fruit? None of my dolls talked or grew hair. In the third grade, Satsuki and I traded our Barbie's limbs so mine could flex her left bicep while hers sat cross-legged, raising one stiff arm like a weapon. If Satsuki has daughters, she might remember the grasshoppers we caught, how we cupped 2 hands together into crooked globes to hear them rattling inside like a small motor. She would tell her daughters, yes, math was hard, but not because we were girls. Okay. The next category that we're going to dip into is on poems by poets with mathematicians in the family. And I have a poem here by John Updike, and I'm sure most of you know Updike. He, of course, was a Pulitzer Prize winner. And let's see here, 22. And he wrote 22 books, primarily known for his fiction. And his father was a high school mathematics teacher. And this is a excerpt from a poem called Midpoint, The Play of Memory. And I believe this one also is a sonnet. Sonnets are 14 lines typically. And they can be in various formats. Some of them rhyme at the end points. Father, as old as you when I was 4, I feel the recklessness of nearing death, but lack your manic passion to endure your stoic fortitude and Christian faith. Remember at the blackboard factoring? My life at midpoint seems a string of terms in which an error plants the hidden spring of resolution, canceling confirms. Top-heavy Dutchman, sundered from the sea, bewitched by money, believing in riddles, Syrian vagrants propagated, we incline to live by what the world belittles. God screws the lukewarm, slays the heart that faints, and saves his deepest silence for his saints.
Catherine Essinger teaches writing at a college in Ohio, at Edison College. Her twin brother is a mathematician, and their similarities and differences are often subjects for her poems. This one is You Are Right by Catherine Essinger. In your super logical, analytical, bumbling way, with halting speech and much digression, you explain that male mathematicians are rarely verbal. Oh, by the way, did I mention that this theory is largely unproven, but nevertheless quite provable? Because of a prenatal superdose of testosterone to the left side of the brain, which suppresses the right side of the brain, where you are currently trying to express your lack of verbal agility. While at the same time peeling an orange, stroking your mustache, pulling your ear, and making little finger signals. And I am about to conclude that you are right.
A.E. Stallings is an American poet living in Greece. And this particular poem, Sin Qua Non, was written for her father, who taught statistics at Georgia State University. Your absence, father, is nothing. It is not the factor by which nothing will multiply. The gap of a drop stitch, the needle's eye weeping its black thread. It is the spot blindly spreading behind the looking glass. It is the startled silences that come when the refrigerator stops its hum and the crickets pause to let the winter pass. Your absence, father, is nothing, for it is Omega's long last O. Memory's elision, the fraction of impossible division, the element I move through, emptiness, the void stars hanging, the interstices of lace, the zero that still holds the sum in place. Okay, and the next section is on counting and math anxiety.
The poem that Karen just read by Alicia Stallings and this next one by Philip Larkin are among my favorites. Larkin was a British poet who lived until 1985 and continues to be recognized as one of the finest poets of the 20th century. This short poem by Philip Larkin is called Counting. Thinking in terms of one is easily done. One room, one bed, one chair, one person there makes perfect sense. One set of wishes can be met, one coffin filled. But counting up to two is harder to do, for one must be denied before it's tried.
This is my poem that was accepted for the anthology, and it has been anthologized in numerous other books, including a book that was called Hungry as We Are. And so this is the dialectic of the census takers. Last night, in the dislabor of falling asleep, I dreamed my sheep had gone astray. Reproducing Fibonacci sums of lands which escaped my repose into your wakefulness. You asked, the recipe, could I have the recipe? Even as my body made its nightly mends, I countered formula. If you do want the formula, you sulked. I thought you were hungry too. From the wool of every bleating you, a mathematician sprang, Archimedes, Newton, Gauss. More, they demanded, more. The sheep couldn't keep pace with their ability to count. But you insisted, I didn't have enough. In this world, not all of us can find our own nourishment. But tonight, dear friend, hunger keeps us awake, and the sheep are somnambulating from my pillow to yours. There is nothing to do and nothing to eat. Nothing, nothing but sleep. Oh, and I have one more poem to read here. And that is by a poet named Abby Mishal. And she is an Israeli poet, 12 books of prize-winning poetry books. And she teaches, well, she was a poet in residence at the university recently. And this is called Geese. My math teacher, Epstein, liked to call me to the blackboard. He said that my head was only good for hats, and that a bird with brains like mine would fly backwards. He sent me to tend the geese. Now, at a distance of years from his sentence, when I sit under the palm tree with my three beautiful geese, I think that math teacher of mine was far-sighted. He was right, because nothing makes me happier than to watch them now, falling upon breadcrumbs, joyful tails wagging, or freezing for a moment under beads of water when I spray them with a hose, holding their heads erect, bodies stretched back as if remembering far away lakes. Since then, my math teacher has died together with the math problems I could never solve. I like hats, and always at evening when the birds return to the tree, I look for the one flying backwards. And here we're going to transition into a new category that we'll just put a label on, mathematical puzzle. So this is your cue to figure out what the heck is going on in this particular piece. And it's by Carl André. He's a New York sculptor, and he was a leading artist of the minimalist movement in the mid-1960s. On the sadness. The door is closed. We are going to die if the moon changes. The sky is blue. Then we are going to die if the grass is green. We are going to die then. We are going to die if the sea is cold. The window is open. We are going to die if the sky is blue, if men grow old. Night come slowly. We are going to die, then the sky is blue if the grass is green. The sky is blue if a girl sings. We are going to die if the sun is hot. Morning comes at 5 o'clock. We are going to die, then we are going to die if the sky is blue. Then we are going to die. The grass is green if men grow old. We are going to die if a boy runs. The sky is blue, the sea is cold. We are going to die, then the grass is green. Fathers, go to work. We are going to die if the sky is blue, if this grass is green. Mothers, mind their children. We are going to die, then we are going to die if men grow old. The sky is blue, then the sky is blue. We are going to die if a girl sings. The grass is green, then we are going to die. We are going to die, then the sky is blue, if the sky is blue. The moon changes. We are going to die if the sea is cold. The sky is blue if men grow old. We are going to die, then we are going to die if the grass is green. The sun is hot. We are going to die if the sky is blue, then we are going to die. A boy runs. We are going to die, then we are going to die, then we are going to die. The sky is blue if the grass is green. We are going to die, if men grow old, a girl sings. We are going to die, then we are going to die if the sky is blue, the sea is cold. We are going to die if the grass is green. The sky is blue, then we are going to die. We are going to die, then the sky is blue, men grow old. We are going to die if the sky is blue, the grass is green. We are going to die, then we are going to die, the sky is blue. We are going to die.
When a poet uses a particular structure for a poem, it needn't necessarily be revealed to the reader. And the reader may not even, you know, be curious about it. But you may, I'm going to tell, whether you're curious or not. Carl Andre's poem used to structure the phrases, the fundamental theorem of arithmetic. And the phrase, we are going to die, corresponds to the prime two. And the poem starts with a line that corresponds to the prime 47 and counts backwards down to two. And the, well, there are a number of phrases, one for each prime, which build the lines of the poem. And you may want to look at it later with that in mind. I have a poem that I'm going to read of my own that has a similar structure. It's not as long as Andre's poem. And it has a different subject. Besides being National Poetry Month, this is National Mathematics Awareness Month. And the theme for Mathematics Awareness Month is mathematics and climate. And this poem then deals with the climate crisis, and it's called We Are the Final Ones. We breathe dirty air. Coral reefs die. We breathe dirty air as we breathe dirty air. Storms are extreme. We breathe dirty air and coral reefs die. Climate change affects the poor. We breathe dirty air as coral reefs die. Coral reefs die as we breathe dirty air. We breathe dirty air and storms are extreme. We drive instead of walk. We breathe dirty air as we breathe dirty air and coral reefs die. Drought is a serial killer. We breathe dirty air and climate change affects the poor first. Coral reefs die, and storms are extreme. We breathe dirty air as we breathe dirty air as we breathe dirty air. What will happen to the polar bears? We breathe dirty air, and coral reefs die as we breathe dirty air. Trash piles grow. We breathe dirty air as we breathe dirty air, and storms are extreme. Coral reefs die, and climate change affects the poor first. What's next? Is it humor?
Yes.
Okay, let me just give you a kind of a plan for the for where we're going, because Joe's going to be reading too. Karen and I are going to alternate with several humorous poems, light verse. And then you may recall from the announcement for the program tonight that guest poets were invited to come and read. And Joe Auslander has brought a poem.
Not mine, by the way. But
your poem, but yeah. He has brought a poem that he will introduce and read. And then we will have a couple final poems. Okay, Karen, I think you're starting, aren't you?
Yes. Okay, the next poem is a limerick, and it's by Bob Kurosaka. And he is a retired from teaching university level mathematics, and he is an American of Japanese parents. And he says of himself that he's as American as sushi pie. And so here is his poem. There was a young maiden. There was a young maiden named Liz, whose mouth had a funny half twist. She turned both her lips into Mobius strips till she kissed you. You haven't been kissed.
If you go to enough films, you occasionally get to see a math poem performed. And such was the case in the 2008 film Harold and Kumar Visit Guantanamo Bay. And that poem ends with a math poem called The Square Root of Three. And Kumar has just returned to his girlfriend, and he is trying to use his poem to win her back. The Square Root of Three by David Feinberg. I'm sure that I will always be a lonely number like root three. The three is all that's good and right. Why must my three keep out of sight beneath the vicious square root sign? I wish instead I were a nine, for nine could thwart this evil trick with just some quick arithmetic. I know I'll never see the sun as 1.7321. Such is my reality, a sad irrationality. When hark, what is this I see? Another square root of a three, quietly co-waltzing by. Together now we multiply to form a number we prefer, rejoicing as an integer. We break free from our mortal bonds with the wave of magic wands. Our square root signs become unglued. Your love for me has been renewed. Needless to say, the film had a happy ending.
If you don't recognize the name of this author, your children or grandchildren definitely will. Shel Silverstein. Okay, and it's called Smart. My dad gave me $1 bill because I'm his smartest son, and I swapped it for two shiny quarters because two is more than one. And then I took the quarters and traded them to Lou for three dimes. I guess he don't know that three is more than two. Just then along came old blind Bates. And just because he can't see, he gave me four nickels for my three dimes, and four is more than three. And I took the nickels to Hiram Coombs down at the seed feed store, and the fool gave me five pennies for them, and five is more than four. And then I went and showed my dad, and he got red in the cheeks and closed his eyes and shook his head, too proud of me to speak.
This next is another limerick by John Ward McClellan. McClellan was a lithographer who enjoyed recreational mathematics and was a friend and collaborator of Martin Gardner on recreational math. The title of the limerick is A Lady of 80. A lady of 80 named Gertie had a boyfriend of 60 named Bertie. She told him emphatically that viewed mathematically by modulo 50, she's 30.
Dan Clark is a former athlete and a CEO of a multi-million dollar corporation, as well as a public speaker, songwriter, and recording author. He has spoken everywhere in the world, and had poems published in Chicken Soup for the Soul. And here is his poem called Practical Application. He's teaching her arithmetic. He said it was his mission. He kissed her once, he kissed her twice, and said, now that's addition. And as he added smack by smack, in silent satisfaction, she sweetly gave the kisses back and said, now that's subtraction. Then he kissed her, she kissed him without an explanation, and both together smiled and said, that's multiplication. Then Dad appeared upon the scene and made a quick decision. He kicked the kid 3 blocks away and said, that's long division. Okay, and now we have our guest.
Nope, one more.
Oh, one more. One
yeah.
more.
Yeah, sorry.
Michael Steuben teaches at Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology in Alexandria, where he integrates the Moore method into his high school teaching. And he has a short 4-line poem which would make a perfect Valentine and is entitled Valentine. You are the fairest of your sex. Let me be your hero. I love you as 1/x. As X approaches 0. Anyhow, and now we have a poet and mathematician retired from the University of Maryland, Joe Auslander, who has a poem from a friend or acquaintance that he will announce and read.
I want to thank Jim and Karen for this wonderful program and allowing me to be out. I did, by the way, here and meet the Amachai in Washington when he was read at the Library of Congress. So the as you know, he died a few years ago. All right, this is a poem by a friend of mine, Frank Dukes. I'll just say a word or two about him. He's an American born in New York, but now he lives in Bath, England, where he has an antique business. And his poems have appeared in various literary magazines, and one was recently commended at a national poetry competition in the UK. And this is the poem is, I hear the scratching of my pen. I hear the scratching of my pen across the page. Each trailing word is meant to signify or represent an act or thing, an attribute, of course, assuming all these exist, or is a modifier or a link connecting others. You would think just as each extra digit that appears in decimal succession brings us ever closer, closing right up to the value of, say, pi, although the final purity of pi can never be attained, our approximation can be infinitely refined, that we should similarly find by using words in limitless addition the elusive heart of truth could be exposed and yield yet greater clarity in proportion to prolixity. So with contingent clauses interposed among our parenthetical exclusions, modifiers qualified, qualifiers modified, and endlessly elaborate locutions we gradually approach, reveal, uncover, or state, express, communicate the very truth that lies in wait. At pi, it is a godlike foe, and they will be outnumbered. How futile. For pi itself can easily be found if we just take a compass or a length of string and simply draw a circle or throw a stone into a pond. Now, picture, if you can, a Russian shtetl called Chelm, a Jewish town within the Pale, a century past when its citizens were famous for their mental acrobatics. A man is sitting in a tavern looking very sad. A friend asks, Abe, so? What's so bad? They speak in Yiddish, but I translate. He says, Ben, he says, I have to go to Bialystok. So? And half an hour I start, I hitch up my horse to the cart. A whole day I'll be down that road and back. 24 hours, I can't afford the time. Okay, Ben says, here's what I'll do. I'll lend you my horse. You'll have 2. With twice the power and half your cut your time, it'll only take 12 hours. And wait, says another, I can lend you my 2 horses. That'll send you speeding along at a fantastic rate. With 4 horses, you only take 6 hours. Mine too, another voice says. 2 more. 6 horses, hour down to 4. The tavern keeper then joins in. Take ours, he shouts. Wait, says Ben. Look, better still, I'll tell you what you do. Go around, take every horse that can be found in Helm, hitch them up and don't go at all.
with a pair of poems. The last one will be hers. This one is by the Chilean poet Pablo Neruda, who died in 1973 after winning the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1971. One of the ways that you may know some things about Neruda is that his political exile was the subject of a film in the mid-90s called Il Postino. That's quite a lovely film if you haven't seen it. This is Ode to Numbers, and it's translated from the Spanish by Margaret Sayers Peden. Oh, the thirst to know how many. The hunger to know how many stars in the sky. We spent our childhood counting stones and plants, fingers and toes, grains of sand, and teeth. Our youth we passed counting petals and comets' tails. We counted colors, years, lives, and kisses in the country oxen, by the sea, the waves. Ships became proliferating ciphers. Numbers multiplied. The cities were thousands, millions. Wheat, hundreds of units that held within them smaller numbers, smaller than a single grain. Time became a number. Light was numbered, and no matter how it raced with sound, its velocity was 37. Numbers surrounded us. When we closed the door at night, exhausted, an 800 slipped beneath the door and crept with us into bed. In our dreams, 4,000s and 77s pounded at our foreheads with hammers and tongs, fives and defies until they sank into the sea or madness, and the sun greeted us with its zero, and we went running to the office, to the workshop, to the factory, to begin again. The infinite one of each new day.
I wrote this poem in honor of this reading. I usually try to write a new poem for readings that I do. So here is Numbers in the Red. Instead of remodeling the kitchen, even replacing the chipped dishes, mismatched forks, knives, spoons, Jim and I choose China, Forbidden City, Great Wall, the life-size terracotta, soldiers, 6,400 warriors, archers, infantrymen, each with a unique face and alert eyes to see the first Qin emperor into the afterlife. At home, with a national debt of 10.9 trillion American dollars and counting, the U.S. population, that's Jim and me, two of the over 306 million warm bodies, owes as an American family $110,000, and this doesn't include our mortgage or credit card debt. My goal before I leave is to read and speak numbers 1 to 10 in Chinese. The least I can do for the 1 billion plus people of the most populous nation on earth, the one tending American debt. Give me an abacus so I can click, click, 1 E, 2 R, up to 10 sure. If I know Chinese 1 to 10, I know every number up to 100. Surely my Semitic ancestors walked the first abacus along the Silk Road to Xi'an. If I know unlucky 4, sir, digit of death, we will be nourished, even when we return home to numbers in the red and a stove with only 3 out of 4 burners working.